Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Masquerades of Spring by Ben Aronovich, narrated by Cobner Holdbrook Smith.
Chapter 1. As I have often opined, what good does it do a fellow to be a master of the mystic arts if he's not allowed to do a bally thing with said mastery? And while I'll admit that knocking the toppers off one's fellow practitioners at Goodwood might have been a tad childish, it hardly, to my mind, constituted a hanging offence. Alas, the old sticks at the folly didn't see eye to eye with me on this, so I decided that perhaps it would be wise to remove myself somewhere out of their censorious gaze until the blissful waters of Lethe bathed their cares away, or something. Since I'm not at all partial to the joys of the rustic, I took a fast liner to New York, where the folly, so I thought, never ventures. Wrongly, as it happened, but we shall get to that later. I found a very pleasant flat, or apartment, as they call it over there, overlooking Washington Square, and engaged a valet to handle all the day-to-day necessaries. In fact, a word about my valet Beauregard is probably in order at this point of the story. Before all the Sturm und Drang and other furies have a chance to intrude. I had arrived at my new apartment on Washington Square and was standing trunkless in an empty hallway when the doorbell rang, hoping that it might be my luggage. I threw the door open to reveal a tall-coloured gentleman with a long, serious face and a sympathetic manner. When he spoke, it was with one of those cultured Southern American accents that rolls around you in a soothing fashion, and I was in need of soothing, being adrift in a foreign city without furniture or even my baggage.
"My name is Maximilian Beauregard," he said. "I believe sir is in need of a valet."
"Gosh," I said, and because I had even yet to make inquiries, "how on earth did you know?"
"You mentioned your need to the elevator operator, sir, and knowing I was looking for a position, he contacted me immediately."
"I say, that's dashed efficient."
"Thank you for noticing, sir."
"You'd better come in," I said, and the man floated in as if on a cushion of air. "You wouldn't happen to know where my trunks have got to?" I asked.
"In fact, I encountered them downstairs in the foyer, sir, and took the liberty of engaging some porters to bring them up."
"Jolly good," I said. "And furniture?"
"I'm sure Macy's would be delighted to send over a man with the catalogue, sir."
"Food?"
"This is New York, sir,"
said Beauregard, with just a touch of hauteur.
"Food will not be a problem."
"You're engaged," I said.
"Very good, sir."
An English gentleman of means can live very pleasantly in New York if he's sensible and doesn't upset the natives. Even the local constabulary, who appear to be Fenians to a man, are, with the exception of the odious Sergeant Bracknell, perfectly respectful if you're polite and don't get in their way. There are some very passable restaurants, art galleries, and concert halls, if high culture is persona grata, as it were, but where New York has it over London in spades is modern music. And for the best of that, one must venture above 110th Street to the neighbourhood they call Harlem. There, a gentleman can seek out the company of like-minded gentlemen while listening to the best jazz in the world. So, as you can imagine, as I lay in bed one bright May morning, sipping my first reviving cup of coffee, proper tea being beyond my man Beauregard's otherwise extensive capabilities, I was taken aback when the man himself knocked on my door and announced that I had a visitor.
"He's an English gentleman, sir,"
said he. Now, all my acquaintances, both English and American, know better than to bother old Augustus before the noon bell, so I did rather wonder who this might be. An unaccountable ripple of apprehension passed over the normally placid surface of my morning routine. but I manfully rose above such turbulence. English visitors are not unheard of, and the steamers did have a habit of docking at an ungodly hour. And so the poor blighter, a stranger in a strange land, might be in need of succour. And let it never be said of Augustus Berrycloth Young that he did not rise to the occasion when it came time to cross the street and offer help. Once I was suitably bathed and fortified, that is. Had I known the truth of it, I would have immediately hidden under my bed and instructed Beauregard to inform my visitor that I had been struck down by the plague during the night. Instead, I took another sip of the blessed dark fruit of the bean. "Does this gentleman have a name?" I asked.
Mr. Thomas Nightingale," said Beauregard.
Now, readers of what I suppose I might call my oeuvre might already be familiar with magic, the demi-monde and the folly, but for those of you who have unaccountably hitherto avoided the outpourings of my pen, I shall briefly explain. Back in the age of enormous wigs, Sir Isaac Newton took time off between inventing gravity and hanging counterfeiters to discover magic. He entrusted this knowledge to a fine, upstanding body of gentlemen who formed the Society of the Wise, known to all those in the know as the Folly. From the famous poem, because our illustrious forebears liked to joke as much as the next man. As was the vogue in those days, they founded a school to pass their wisdom on to the next generation, and it was to this prestigious institution that young Augustus was entrusted in the summer of 1914. It's become fashionable to bemoan one's school days, to dwell upon the canings, the cold and the loneliness, but I must say I had a jolly time at school, made some very good chums, and, most importantly of all, learnt magic. You may be thinking, "Magic, Gussie, my dear boy, there's no such thing." And that would be because, as a respectable graduate of Casterbrook, and a member in good standing with the Folly, I am duty-bound to keep the existence of magic hush-hush, sub rosa, and on, as they might say here in New York, the down-low. Magic in the wrong hands, or even in no hands at all, can be a dangerous thing, and it was the Folly who was charged with keeping the peace, maintaining order, and ensuring the nation's horses went unaffrighted. This solemn task had made the old sticks at the Folly a grim and humourless bunch, who tended to look askance whenever a young wizard, in a moment of exuberance, applied his mighty art to the task of de-helmeting the local constabulary, crockering troublesome strangers, or acquiring refreshments at Cheltenham by levitating bottles of champagne away from their coolers. As I mentioned at the beginning, it was to avoid their opprobrium for such a similar trifling matter that I crossed the Atlantic in the first place. Therefore, you can imagine my trepidation upon being informed that the Folly's chief Bruno, the man they send forth into the world to solve problems and shoot trouble, one Thomas Nightingale, Esquire, was even now loitering at my door. Still, we graduates of Casterbrook are bywords for fortitude, and rather than fleeing down the fire escape, I instead bade Beauregard to show the Nightingale, for that is how he was often styled, into the living room and offer refreshments while I quickly bathed and dressed. Beauregard, ever an optimist with regards to the weather, had laid out one of my recently acquired linen suits in dove grey and cut in the jazz style, which close acquaintances agreed suited my figure very well. Then, suitably togged up, I stuck my courage to the sticking post and advanced with as much insouciance as I could manage upon the living room. "What ho, Thomas!" I cried as I entered. Now, I have often said that the principal difference between the musical offerings of Cecil and Blake, Gershwin and Gershwin, Rogers and Hart, and those of the likes of Verdi, Tosca, and some other bally Italian I have forgotten the name of, is that one might take one's seat for the former with no fear that one will leave the theatre none the wiser with regards to the story, whereas on those occasions when I have been dragged bodily to the opera, I have spent the entire show trying to work out why man A is singing angrily at man B while woman C trills sadly in the corner. And to rub salt into the wound, as it were, I have the strongest feeling that everybody else in the theatre but me knows exactly what is going on. My friend Lucy, who is an aficionado, tells me that if only I were to read the libretto beforehand, then I might stop worrying about the plot and concentrate on the music, which is the main concern of the piece. It is in this spirit that I feel I should introduce Thomas Nightingale before we, figuratively, meet him on that fateful spring morning so that you, the reader, may have a better understanding of the plot and, in consequence, have a heightened appreciation of the music. Otherwise, the story might stray into those overlong digressions that are the bane of the modern novel. He was a tall cove with a chiselled jaw, grey eyes, and brown hair that, while cut short at the sides, had a tendency towards unruly behaviour up top. That, and a smooth chin, meant that while he was a good 4 years older than I, he could, when the mood took him, look younger. He could appear as languid and as carefree as the next young blade, but I had it on good authority that he had dealt with some pretty dicey situations, both at home and abroad. Looking at him, taking his ease at my window seat and perusing my copy of the New York Herald Tribune, I knew trouble, even when it was wearing a rather fine tweed travelling suit. "Gussie," he cried, leaping to his feet and seizing my hand.
"Good to see you. I wonder if it's not too much trouble if I may impose upon your hospitality for a couple of nights."
"Of course," I cried while thinking of the many splendid hotels, especially along Broadway, that would be even more ecstatic to receive him as a guest. "What brings you to New York, business or pleasure?"
Business, of course,"
he said, and my heart sank. Because whereas many members of the Society of the Wise had professional or business interests outside the folly, Thomas Nightingale was not one of them. If he were in New York on business, it could only be of a magical nature. "Jolly good," I said, for want of anything more sensible. I glanced at the clock and saw, with an inward shudder, that it was but a quarter past the hour of 10. Not only an uncivilized hour to be up and awake, but also far too early for lunch. "Can I offer you some elevenses?"
"Thank you," he said, "but your man here has already provided me with coffee."
He glanced at Beauregard, who was floating attentively nearby.
"However, I do need to talk to you in confidence."
"I can take a hint." So, after Beauregard had provided me with another blessed and much-needed cup of the bean, I dispatched him off to undertake various errands with the strong intimation that he need not return until after lunch. Nightingale watched him go and turned to me.
"Sound fellow?"
he asked. "I've always found him so," I said. "So, what is this dashed business that brings you here? I can assure you I have been as circumspect as a vicar at a christening." Nightingale smiled and raised his hand in a most bishop-like beneficence.
"I'm here on quite another matter,"
he said.
"One that, given your familiarity with the terrain, I expect you can assist me with."
"Oh, yes," I said somewhat guardedly.
"I wish to locate the point of manufacture of a saxophone," he said.
"A saxophone?" I cried, boggled.
"An enchanted saxophone."
"What on earth would anyone enchant a saxophone to do?"
"In the first instance," said Nightingale, "it can impart a greater level of skill to the player. In the second instance, when played correctly, this one can talk."
I was agog. "What does it say?" I asked.
"That depends on the musician,"
said Nightingale.
"The chap who owned it had learnt how to play hallo, yes and no, but as far as the boffins could determine, The instrument had no will of its own. It said, or rather sang, what its owner played.
The owner in this case was one Lawrence Elwood, a Jamaican chap who had arrived in London by way of New York.
Have you ever heard of him?
Asked Nightingale. Can't say I have, I said, although I knew Lucy would know. Lucy had a mind like one of those bally card catalogues they have in the libraries. If you have ever puckered, plucked, bowed, or sung in New York, then Lucy will have your details. It can be uncanny, and would have been dashed useful had I any intention of introducing Lucy to the Nightingale, or vice versa. But I have learnt from bitter experience to keep certain parts of my world separate from the others.
No matter, said Nightingale. Mr. Elwood was quite cooperative when it became clear that we were willing to replace the instrument with one of an equal but unenchanted quality. Plus a finder's fee, of course.
Of course, I said. Mr. Elwood did furnish Nightingale with the name and address of the pawn shop from whence he had acquired the instrument. I'd never been there myself, but one of the benefits of the American obsession of laying out their towns in grids is that addresses are easy to find. This one was on West 47th Street, close to the corner with 10th Avenue, deep inside the neighbourhood known as Hell's Kitchen, a well-deserved name for an area with a terrible reputation for criminality and danger. Lucy had cautioned me against setting foot in the place, so of course Nightingale was all for heading out there on the instant. Well, it seemed like a rum thing, but we wizards have a code, and never let it be said that Augustus Berrycloth Young shirked his duty as a keeper of the secret flame. Not that I have the faintest idea where the secret flame might possibly be, although I assume that's because it's a secret. In any case, I rose to the occasion, and we hailed a rather fetching green and red taxicab and set forth for 47th Street. The shop itself was a sort of cluttered Aladdin's cave with two glass counters. There was a cornucopia of watches, rings, and silver cutlery under glass in the counters, and ranks of musical instruments, barometers, and rifles along the walls. A line of trumpets hung from hooks like skinned rabbits next to what I am sure was a bally balalaika, or possibly a lute. Stacked in the gaps were teetering piles of steamer trunks and suitcases, showing, I presumed, a great deal of confidence amongst newly arrived travellers that New York was their final destination. A sign above the back counter proclaimed Loan Department and Diamonds Appraised. I was assailed by 100 types of vestigium. Have I explained vestigia yet? No. For trained practitioners, it's easy to forget that most people don't recognize a vestigium when they encounter it. Quite simply, magic, even the magic of the everyday, leaves behind a trace which old Isaac called a vestigium. You probably encounter it every day, but dismiss it as a random sound or smell or a passing fancy. It is as insubstantial as a daydream, and most often, even to the magically trained, as useful. In any case, locations such as pawn shops, libraries, and lost property stores accumulate a great many of these whispers and fancies, and so I ignored them now as irrelevant. But Augustus, the reader might cry, if this vestige whatnot is irrelevant, what was the point of that whole paragraph? To which I can only counsel patience, dear reader. Vestigia will become relevant soon enough. A stout man with a square face, a savage moustache, and an inappropriately snazzy Homburg hat graced us with a nod and a minatory gaze.
How may I help you, gentlemen?
He said in a manner that suggested that in truth he would rather not provide any such help.
A friend of mine purchased a musical instrument from this shop last year,
said Nightingale.
No refunds, said the Homburg. A refund will not be necessary, said Nightingale. We are merely looking for some information.
Are you cops?
No,
said Nightingale.
You's a Seamus?
The man pronounced you as if it had a Z at the end. Nightingale glanced at me and raised an inquiring eyebrow. Private detective, I said.
No,
said Nightingale, turning back to the man with the ferocious moustache.
A friend of ours bought a musical instrument here, and we'd merely like to establish who originally pledged it.
Nightingale showed the man the receipt, but the man looked unimpressed or just possibly uncomprehending. Nightingale was about to repeat his explanation when the man shook his head.
Sorry, Mac,
he said. Can't help you.
I'm willing to make it worth your while,
said Nightingale. This caught the man's immediate attention, and he indicated that he was desirous to see the colour of our money. It was at this point that Nightingale revealed that he was indeed fatally short of American currency, and asked me to step in and shoulder the financial burden. I would be lying if I said I wasn't a little put out, and having my ear bitten in so cavalier a fashion. But I could hardly say this in front of the moustache, and so I rustled up the rhino, and if Nightingale proved a little over-generous in his estimation of how much this moustache's time was worth, then I did not feel that just then was the appropriate moment to mention it. Things took a turn for the rummy when the moustache asked to examine the receipt again, but when Nightingale unwisely handed the thing over, he stuffed it into the maw that, rather alarmingly, opened under his bristling lip hedge. Then he chewed thoughtfully for a moment or two before swallowing. They say that ignorance is bliss, and in fact that is the unofficial motto of a folly. But had our mustachioed friend any inkling of who he was dealing with, what followed might not have come as such a surprise. He certainly wouldn't have given Nightingale that challenging and what are you going to do about it look. Not if he, like me, had ever watched Nightingale play indoor tennis.
I see,
said Nightingale.
I thought it was a very fair bribe. Wouldn't you say so, Gussie?
Generous, I said, and because I was still stung by the expense, more than generous, in fact.
I'm going to count to five,
said Nightingale.
And before I reach the end, you will provide us with the information we seek, or,
he glanced over his shoulder to flash a grin at me,
return my friend's investment.
Moustache bristled, neither option being to his taste. Even as Nightingale reached the number two, he opened that fearsome sub-moustachio maw and bellowed,
Jake, get your ass out here.
Then the poor, deluded fool gave Nightingale the sort of smug look your rival gives you when you slice your ball into a bunker on the first hole, thinking the match is all over, bar the counting out of winnings. In response, Nightingale stopped counting and waited for Jake. Jake, another stout man in a Homburg, but this time mercifully clean-shaven, arrived a full 10 seconds later, bursting through a door at the back and brandishing a shotgun. Before he could take aim, Nightingale, without taking his eyes off the moustache, made a small gesture with his left hand. As if by invisible hands, the shotgun was wrenched from Jake's grasp and sent skidding across the floor to stop at my feet. Simultaneously, the poor man was pitched forward and slammed into the ground. There was a crack and a pained grunt.
Gussie, said Nightingale, keep an eye on him for me, old boy.
I would be lying if I said I didn't relish the chance to have a bit of a magical tussle, although it did seem a bit unsporting to inflict spells upon unsuspecting shopkeepers. I'm all for snatching off a policeman's helmet or pulling a prank upstairs at the Folly or the Bliss, but this seemed a mite more serious. That worried me. The moustache reached under the counter, no doubt seeking a weapon of his own, but froze when something bright and metallic flashed past his face. One of a myriad drawers behind him had opened, and a dozen or so table knives had floated out to orbit his head. Judging correctly that any sudden moves would be unwise, the man straightened slowly until he was staring at Nightingale, with his eyes bulging in surprise. They flicked back and forth, vainly trying to track the knives as they flashed past his face. Now, said Nightingale, let us start our conversation again. Chapter 2.
Just who is the killer?
Asked Nightingale as we left the pawn shop. A Mr. Madden, I said, top gangster of this parish. Those two were probably in his employ, or even more likely under his protection. Said Nightingale, with a delighted and wholly inappropriate grin.
This must be one of those famous protection rackets I've read about.
The very same, I said gloomily.
So, when he warned us that this killer would be taking an interest, that was in the nature of a threat?
Said Nightingale. I indicated that, indeed, that was the case, although this did not seem to concern Nightingale one jot. An attitude that roused me to a state of ire at odds with my normally sunny disposition. I say, Thomas, you may be planning to hop off back to Blighty on the next liner, but I happen to like it here, I said, and I'd rather you didn't queer the pitch. Gussie, said Nightingale with some surprise.
Are you planning to settle?
What if I am? I said.
Good for you, he said. I wouldn't worry about the killer. I've dealt with these types of ruffians before. They're all bluster, and they're as terrified of Mr. Madden, was it?
Only Madden, I said.
Welsh?
Asked Nightingale. Born in Leeds, apparently.
Those men will be as terrified of Mr. Only Madden as anyone else, he said. And since nothing was lost from the shop except their pride, they're unlikely to bring it to his attention. These gangsters have little time for subordinates who waste their time.
While it sounded dashed plausible, I decided that I would endeavour to avoid Hell's Kitchen in future, if only to put Lucy's mind at rest. Since finding an available cab in Hell's Kitchen was unlikely, we had started strolling east towards the theatre district. It must have rained while we were in the jumble sale cave of wonders, for the streets were washed clean and gleaming in the spring sunshine. New York is at its best on days such as these, when it's fresh and full of possibilities. On such days, it's hard to feel anything less than the jolly old joie de vivre, and the savage mustachioed one had, with some reluctance, given us a name.
A name is not much to go on, said Nightingale.
Au contraire, I said, with, I think, a justifiable degree of smugness. We know that he played the saxophone. That should be enough.
Are you certain?
I know a man, I said, in Harlem. Before we transport our scene to Harlem, I feel I should explain about Lucy. Before I can do that, I must make a confession, which may come as a shock to many of my readers, since it is an aspect of my life that I have kept hitherto under a veil. Before reading further, many of you may wish to ensure that you are comfortably seated with a restorative tipple ready within easy reach. As well as a practitioner of magic, I am, in fact, also a practitioner of what they call the love that dare not speak its name. Back in old Blighty, a chap like me, of reasonable means and eccentric reputation, can live a carefree life, providing, of course, he doesn't make the grievous error of speaking that name out loud. In London, a chap merely needs to know which clubs one might frequent, or whose soirees to gather at, and, when uncertain, a phrase or two in Polari will settle any doubts. The trouble with moving to New York was that I was ignorant of the appropriate venues, and cheerfully greeting someone as ducky and asking whether they are having a bone a day garners only a puzzled frown. And of course the problem with the love that dare not speak its name is that you dare not speak its name. A bit of a conundrum, you might say. Until one night, while I was shaking a leg at Connie's, and I chanced to catch Lucy's eye, or more precisely, he caught mine. Poets and romantic authors alike speak of love at first sight, but up until that fateful night I had been sceptical. My liaisons had been short and sweet and uncomplicated, and, I like to think, mutually satisfactory, but I had never before been, as it were, so mortally struck by Cupid's arrow. There he was, leaning casually against the wall on the edge of the dance floor, his eyes flicking between the band on stage and a reporter's notebook in which he made occasional marks with a silver propelling pencil. He was a coloured man, taller than me, with a fine, well-shaped head and a full, sensuous mouth. He wore that night, and to my despair on every subsequent occasion, a finely tailored but rumpled tweed suit, his eyes half hidden behind round, gold-rimmed spectacles, were a startlingly intelligent brown. I did not realize I had stopped moving until one of the other dancers stumbled into me. I apologized without looking round, and as if drawn by an invisible lasso, drifted towards this personification of Adonis in tweed. I floated to a stop before him. He looked down, and our eyes met.
"Excuse me,"
he said.
"You're blocking my view of the band."
I moved out of his way, and he gave me an apologetic smile before turning his full attention to the stage. Now, the practice of magic takes both concentration and patience, and it was the latter quality that allowed me to stand next to this personification of Eros for a whole 2 minutes, watching him take meticulous notes in shorthand, before I could stand it no longer and was forced to speak. I say, I said, "are you a reporter, what?"
"What makes you think that?"
he asked, never taking his eyes from his notebook.
"I thought the ballet notebook was a bit of a giveaway," I said, feeling like a man floundering in the sea. "Unless you're stealing the songs," my head going under for the second time, "but I wouldn't recommend it."
That was it. I was lost. Drowned in a sea of inarticulacy and coming to a sad end, just as my old headmaster predicted I would. Lucy turned and looked at me over the gold rims of his spectacles.
"Why wouldn't you?"
he asked. I'd say I was drowning in his eyes, but then I would be drowning twice, and Lucy, who often amuses himself by reading these missives prior to publication, would complain that I'm complicating my metaphors beyond the point of comprehension. Having read some of the modern stuff turned out these days by the Bloomsbury set, I'm rather more inclined to think I was ahead of my time. Still, metaphors aside, I managed to assemble a sentence that would pass muster. "I don't think they're particularly good," I said. And then, because Lucy's eyes never left mine, "not a patch on Bix Beiderbecke. Wouldn't you agree?" There was a long pause while he considered this, and I went down for the third and final time. Then he smiled, and it was like the sun rising over an oasis in the desert, which thankfully meant I was no longer drowning, but at the same time equally lost.
"Have you heard Gladys Bentley yet?"
he asked. I said I had not, which only made the smile wider.
"I think it's time we blow this scene,"
he said. And half an hour later, we were downstairs at a speakeasy on 133rd Street, breathing smoke, drinking terrible hooch, and listening to a young coloured girl in a bow tie and short Eton jacket sing and play the piano all the way to morning. Later, when I told Lucy about the love that dare not speak its name, he held me close and said that it may not speak its name,
but it sure as shit sings the blues.
Lucy, or more formally, Lucien Gibbs, worked in what he liked to call the Negro end of Madison Avenue. There he earned a living writing copy for advertisements to be placed in newspapers and magazines. He pretended to me that he had no interest in the work, but I noticed that he was quick enough to draw my attention to this work when he encountered it in, as it were, the wild. His first love, of course, was his study and writing about the work, lives, and scandals of New York's musicians and singers. As I believe I've intimated before, Lucy's knowledge of such was without peer, and it was in his capacity as an enormous brain that I now planned to consult him. I left Nightingale loitering outside the office and went in. "What ho, Gussie?" called Loretta, the company secretary. She greets me thus every time I come into the office and, for some unfathomable reason, find it a source of tremendous good fun. "What ho, Lottie?" I hallooed back, which only provoked further giggling. "Is the brain about?" Still laughing, Loretta pointed upwards. I skipped past the offices of what Lucy was pleased to call his fellow toilers in the pit of lies. Then I trotted up half a dozen flights of stairs until I emerged onto the roof. There, I found Lucy working at the mechanical monster that he laughably referred to as his portable. The beast, which must have weighed a stone or more, sat upon a rickety card table, and the action was so stiff that Lucy was forced to use a heavy hand when typing. Between the smashing of the keys, the groaning of the table, and Lucy's own mumbled soliloquy, he rarely noticed my approach. I didn't like to disturb him when he was in full flow, so I waited. There was a rhythm to his work, so I knew there'd be a pause ere long. Summer in New York can get infernally hot, and during that season the whole population migrates to the roofs of their apartments and, in the absence of proper balconies, their fire escapes. Sensible people, my expatriate friends assure me, depart for Cape Cod and other points upstate. As a result, the roof of your average New York block of flats can sport a wondrous collection of garden furniture, flower beds, pigeon lofts, and, astonishingly, beehives. Lucy's rooftop hideaway boasted a large marquee tent, of the kind you see sheltering the masses at village fetes on wet Sunday afternoons in the country. This allowed Lucy to labour on the roof even in the most inclement weather. Rain or snow, Lucy said that he worked best when he could look up and see Harlem spread out before him. That day, he sat in the warm afternoon sun, his well-shaped head bent over his work. There was a sudden pause in both the typing and the soliloquy, but I hesitated, having been wrong-footed before.
"At the better fountains everywhere," he cried in triumph, before banging the sentence into being. Then he turned to regard me over the rim of his spectacles.
"Gussie," he said, "what on earth are you doing here?"
I took a quick look over the parapet to make sure Nightingale hadn't happened to anyone, but he seemed quite content to lean on his cane and watch the passers-by. "I have a favour to ask," I said, and filled him in on the quest to discover the source of the magical speaking saxophone, although, of course, I left out both the magical and the speaking parts. Lucy joined me at the parapet and gazed down at Nightingale.
"Is that him?"
he asked. Whenever he stands that close to me, I have a deuced time restraining myself from touching him, but even alone on a roof, it was best to play it safe. "What was the musician's name?" he asked. "David Edwards."
"Saxophone, you say?"
Lucy's face took on the aspect of Aristotle thinking upon Achilles and the tortoise, and he snapped his fingers a dozen times, a surefire sign that the magnificent brain was bent to the task. The snapping stopped, and he looked at me. "You sure he was a saxophonist?" "We know he once owned one," I said, because the masters at my old school had made it very clear that even one as dense as I needed to be precise. Magic can be dangerous if you don't pay attention to the details.
"Pearly Edwards," said Lucy, "used to play the trumpet before the war. I did hear he switched sometime after, but he quit this years ago. He's the Reverend Edwards now, over at the Church of Jesus Christ the Holy on 7th and 140th.
I thanked Lucy and went to leave, but nothing would do but that he would accompany me and Nightingale to the church to facilitate the encounter.
"And besides, I want to meet this Nightingale," he said, "and you've piqued my curiosity about this matter.
I want to know what's really going on. What makes you think something is going on?
You always claim to be a man of independent means, he said.
I am, I said, very independent.
And yet you say this Nightingale's name as if you work for him, said Lucy, and then cocked his head to one side. Nah, that's not right. You say it as if he's your superior officer. That's odd, even allowing for the fact that you're both English. Are you secretly in the army, Gussie?
I don't need to explain to you how absurd is the notion that Augustus Berrycloth Young would don the uniform under any circumstances, short of an invasion by Martians. And that very absurdity helped me come up with a plausible explanation. We went to school together, I said. It's an English thing. Thomas, I said, this is my good friend Lucian Gibbs. Lucian, this is Thomas Nightingale, who was an old chum from school. Lucian and Thomas shook hands, both, to my mind, eyeing each other with equal amounts of suspicion. I was reminded, after my months in New York, away from the folly, just why one does not mix one's social circles, especially when both walk in the shadows, albeit different shadows, possibly on two completely different streets.
So what was the name of the school? Asked Lucy.
It was a very minor school, said Nightingale. You wouldn't have heard of it.
Shall I hail us a cab? I asked quickly.
It's not far, said Lucy, if you two fine gentlemen are up for a stroll.
I used to think that my old school took sport seriously. Nightingale earned much of his reputation playing rugger, cricket and indoor tennis, and so was a darling of the masters. But over here, they take it very seriously indeed, as evinced by the fact that they call a chap who takes more than a passing interest in a particular sport a fan, short for fanatic, don't you see? Even so, it was something of a surprise to walk into a church and find a basketball game in progress, refereed by, Lucy pointed out, the Reverend Edwards himself. In fact, the venue looked more like a gymnasium than a place of worship, although I could see where the pews were stacked neatly against the walls. The players were all schoolboys who ran up and down the court, yelling excitedly. I looked at Nightingale and caught a wistful expression on his face. We were content to watch the game until its finish, especially Lucy, who was a fan of the sport.
We should have played this at Casterbrook,
said Nightingale, no doubt imagining himself as captain of yet another school team. After the Reverend Edwards had blown his whistle and waved the boys off to change and go home, he stopped and gave us a long stare. He was one of those short blighters who come across as much bigger than they really are, with a fairer complexion than Lucy and his hair marcelled into obedience.
Pearly,
said Lucy, and the Reverend's stare lost much of its hostility, at least as far as Lucy was concerned. When he turned his gaze on Nightingale and me, it reacquired a distinctly frosty aspect.
Mr. Gibbs, said Edwards, what brings you to the house of the Lord? I'm guiding these two gentlemen towards the Promised Land,
said Lucy.
I see,
said Edwards, his lips twitching and some of the frost evaporating.
It's not enough that they come up for the music and the dancing, but they want some of that Negro spirituality as well.
Information, Mr. Edwards,
said Nightingale.
That's what we want.
Edwards was suddenly wary.
Are you with the police, sir?
He said, with the deference that belied his former hostility.
No, they're not,
said Lucy, with a sharp note I recognized as anger, although blow me if I knew what he was angry about. We're collectors, I said, from London.
Well, unless you're coming to collect my pews,
said Edwards, indicating where a number of parishioners were heaving the aforementioned off their stacks and laying them out.
I doubt I have anything you gentlemen will want, although salvation is available for everyone, even the English.
That's a relief, I said.
We're interested in the provenance of the saxophone you pawned 5 years ago,
said Nightingale.
I always knew that instrument would come back to haunt me,
he said.
You know it's cursed, right?
Hence our interest,
said Nightingale.
You're interested in things that have been touched by the devil?
Our principals are,
said Nightingale.
They like to be sure that such things are kept safely away, where they won't do any harm.
I never redeemed it, said Edwards. It's either still at the store or they sold it.
The item itself has come into our possession,
said Nightingale.
What interests us is where it came from.
You don't want to get involved in that business,
said Edwards.
Trust me.
What business is that?
The music business, Mr. Nightingale,
said Edwards, looking narrow-eyed at Nightingale.
It's the devil's business and no mistake.
Is that why you gave it up? Asked Lucy suddenly.
You never said. You never asked me before, Lucian,
said Edwards, turning to Lucian, and it seemed to me quite pleased to change the conversation.
That was down to the war. You probably don't know the details.
He turned back to Nightingale and me.
But these two fine European gentlemen might. If I speak of the Ardennes in the fall of 1918, is that enlightening? I was a rattler in the 396th. The colored regiment's so fearsome that our own army was scared of us and made us fight beside the French.
Ah,
said Nightingale in recognition, but I didn't have the slightest notion of what, so I nodded along thoughtfully. It's a technique, by the way, I recommend to any of you who have friends steeped in serious purpose or otherwise intellectually inclined. I've always believed that it's better to stay quiet and encourage such people to believe you're hanging on their every word rather than foolishly open your mouth and give evidence to the contrary. In truth, committing the strings of formi from which spells are derived to memory while at school proved excellent training.
They call us the Hellfighters now, the Harlem Hellfighters,
said Edwards.
But that was the name of the band, and what a band they were. Williams, Taylor, Hawkins, Storms. I was good, but I never made the cut. Company Bugler, that was me. Reveille to get them up and Taps to put them to bed.
Edwards fell silent then and looked down at his shoes. He stayed like that for so long that his parishioners finished laying out the pews and lined up in a respectful silence to wait for him.
I thought music was my life, but after the war, there was too much death mixed in with it,
he said finally.
I switched to the sax because I had some notion that would make a difference, but no. I had to find some way of making the music holy again. You understand that, right, Lucian? You need to understand that. The music will take you down among devils if you ain't careful.
He nodded at me and Nightingale.
The devils.
So where did the saxophone come from?
Asked Nightingale.
It was given to me,
said Edwards,
by the spawn of Satan himself.
Chapter 3. It would probably come as a surprise to the Reverend Peter Walmsley, who led school prayers at Casterbrook, that the devil's name was Mark Harper. The Reverend himself had always contended that the devil was in all of us, and that it was our responsibility to thwart him at every opportunity. Much of this thwarting involved resisting the temptation to handle one's private parts, a prohibition many of us circumvented by handling each other's privates instead. Lucy called this, when I told him about it, the law of unintended consequences. Still, judging from the way the equally Reverend Edwards spat out his name, Mark Harper had done much more than a little late-night self-abuse.
I assume you know this man's whereabouts,
said Nightingale to Lucy once we were back out on the pavement.
Mr. Harper is a music publisher, he said. Has an office on Tin Pan Alley.
And where is this alley located?
Asked Nightingale. If you've been to a show any time recently or listened to a modern record, then the chances are that the music publisher, the chap who owns the music and makes the money, has an office on West 28th Street, otherwise known to the cognoscenti as Tin Pan Alley, for reasons that not even Lucy can explain. Mark Harper worked from an untidy office on the top floor of a shabby building that proved to be a noisy hive of similarly small offices. As we climbed the stairs, a cacophony of pianos, violins, and human voices raised in song or in anger, assailed us. I couldn't help feeling a sense of desperation permeating the whole place. Nightingale appeared unaffected. Lucy had declined to accompany us, and instead said he would take the opportunity to run some errands and meet us outside when we were finished. I couldn't for the life of me think of what errands he might have to run, but if my acquaintance with Lucy has taught me one thing, it is that the life of an advertising executive is full of mystery. Mr. Harper was one of those thin, fair-haired men from whom the colour has drained as they get older, until one gets the impression that one is talking to an old photograph that has come to sudden life. His office was ruthlessly tidy, but the furniture and carpet were worn. Mr. Harper, to my mind, had obviously seen better days. Perhaps this had made him dyspeptic, because Nightingale and I had barely crossed his threshold before he ordered us to leave in the coarsest of terms.
"Fuck off,"
he said again as Nightingale advanced into his office with me as his discreet shadow.
"Good afternoon,"
said Nightingale.
"Are you Mr. Mark Harper?"
"Are you deaf?"
asked Mr. Harper.
"I don't care what you're selling, I'm not buying."
"I'm not selling, sir,"
said Nightingale, and sat in one of the two rickety wooden chairs in front of the desk. I gingerly took my place in the other. Mr. Harper's mouth opened, and his face took on a fine shade of crimson at our effrontery, which was only ameliorated a soupçon when Nightingale explained that we were in pursuit of a purchase. At least the mouth, a large pink maw inhabited by unnaturally white dentures, remained closed as he listened.
"We believe you provided Mr. Edwards with the saxophone in question,"
finished Nightingale. Mr. Harper squinted at us like a fishmonger eyeing a troublesome flounder. He might have been deep in thought or perhaps having difficulty with his digestion. It was hard to tell which. Then a look of naked loathing crossed his face, aimed not at us, but at some inward memory.
"The dull man has her,"
he said. And then, noting our looks of bafflement, he went on to explain.
"Stephen Baker knows all about the saxophone and other things."
Nightingale asked where we might find this Mr. Baker, which caused Mr. Harper to turn dyspeptic all over again.
"He runs a joint on Lenox Avenue," he said, in an airy, disparaging tone. "Name of the Alexandra. That's where you'll find them."
"He was lying,"
said Nightingale, as soon as we were out of the building.
"Was he?"
I asked. "I thought he looked rummy. What do you think he was lying about?"
"Ah,"
said Nightingale.
"My dear Gussie, therein lies our difficulty. Let us see where this lead takes us before we circle back to Mr. Harper and run him to ground."
"Are we looking for magic instruments or hunting foxes?" I asked.
"I see your good friend Mr. Gibbs approaching,"
he said.
"He should be able to guide us to the Alexandra."
We hailed a cab back uptown. Travelling by taxi in the company of Lucy can be dicey, as some cabbies refuse to carry coloured passengers even when accompanied by whites. This time the driver, a solid brute in a flat cap, seemed unperturbed.
10 Pan Alley to Lenox Avenue,
Lucy murmured once we were safely underway.
He figures I'm a musician and you're my manager.
Excellent,
said Nightingale.
That's a story that has potential to get us through the front door.
Although in the event, the front doors were propped open by a mop and bucket, so we entered freely. There can be few things that lack cheeriness, quite as much as a nightclub seen during the day. The stage and the dance floor always seem smaller, the gilt and velvet tarnished and grubby. Voices echo amongst the stacked chairs and empty tables, especially mine. I say, hello, is anyone home?
Stop,
said Nightingale.
Can you feel that?
I dutifully stopped and let my eyes close. I could definitely feel something, a smell of pine and the whisper of the wind amongst leaves. And through it a dainty little tune, something continental played on a fiddle or a flute.
Feel what?
Asked Lucy.
Certain places accumulate.
Nightingale paused, looking for a word.
A vibration, if you like. A memory of a certain category of event.
What kind of an event?
Unusual events of a specific type,
said Nightingale. And to me...
Can you feel it?
I told him I could.
That was a less than helpful answer, said Lucy.
No doubt Gussie can explain,
said Nightingale.
But later, not here, not now.
Up on the bandstand, a coloured chap was practising a phrase on one of those modern, shortened grand pianos in the so-called stride idiom. He looked up as we approached and, to nobody's surprise, save perhaps Nightingale's, recognised Lucy. They greeted each other in a friendly fashion, and we were introduced as fellow jazz aficionados from London. The pianist's name was Lloyd Beaumont, and he joked that he'd come north to New York so he could avoid singing the blues. Pretty soon we were having a friendly disagreement about whether Fats Waller owed anything to James P. Johnson, with Lloyd having the unfair advantage of being able to make his points by playing quotations on the ivories. In fact, we got so chummy that I didn't notice Nightingale had evaporated away until he drifted back.
Perhaps you can help satisfy my curiosity,
said Nightingale. Lloyd shrugged and said he would if he could.
We've heard rumours that the owner of this establishment has access to musical instruments of extraordinary quality,
he said.
Have you ever heard anything like that?
Lloyd's left hand danced back and forth to the bass notes on the piano. This baby is quite a sweet thing if you know how to treat her, he said.
Yes, it is,
said Nightingale.
But I'm thinking of something a little more unusual.
I saw Lucy wanted to speak, but I put a hand on his arm to quell him. Unusual how? Asked Lloyd.
Imbued with an unusual spirit,
said Nightingale.
That meant it was played not just better, but much better than you thought the musician warranted.
Can't say as I have, beyond, you know, the usual magic,
said Lloyd, and played a chord.
Nothing strange at all? Asked Nightingale.
Ha, said Lloyd. This is Harlem. Just about everything strange here. Mr. Baker did have this creepy frail that he used to bring around.
Creepy?
Asked Nightingale.
How?
Very tall and long and pale, said Lloyd. Always wore a veil over her face. Used to drift around the club when they was dancing. Never spoke, never smoked. Like I said, creepy.
Lloyd grinned at me and Lucy.
Loved the music, though, you could tell. You can always tell the true believers from the dilettantes. Doran says you'd find her dancing backstage. Terrible dancer, too. Couldn't keep time worth a damn. Used to wave her arms around like she was a tree in the wind. I reckon she was kicking the gong around.
But, he admitted, he hadn't seen her around for a while. Nightingale asked after Pearlie Edwards, and Lloyd said he remembered him playing a few nights at the Alexandra and some other clubs and bars. He'd played the sax back then. In fact, Lloyd was quite surprised he'd played the trumpet before the war.
He was definitely cokey back then. A lot of the Hellfighters went that way after the war, said Lloyd. I heard he cleaned himself up and took up preaching over on 140th.
As we left, Lloyd called after Lucy.
I'm expecting a good review in the next edition, he said. Only if you play somewhere they let me in the damn audience,
Lucy called back. We retired to a little place on 133rd Street and introduced Nightingale to properly cooked fried chicken. I'd recently become very familiar with Harlem cuisine since the restaurant downtown was strangely reluctant to serve Lucy, which was, in his opinion, no great loss. Harlem, Lucy contends, contains all that a man might need, including, and this part used to puzzle me, the illusion of freedom. Mr. Stephen Baker III had been nowhere to be found.
I did have a chance to have a quick look through his office desk,
said Nightingale, who apparently had made good use of his period of evaporation.
But I didn't find anything useful. Something unusual had spent time in there, if I'm any judge.
When you say unusual, said Lucy, what do you mean?
How much has Gussie told you about magic?
Asked Nightingale. It is said that the one rule about the folly is you don't talk about the folly, and this is true providing you ignore all the other rules, including the prohibition on playing indoor tennis on the upper balcony. But it is fair to say that from our first day at Casterbrook, we were urged to discretion. Magic is fabulously dangerous to the untrained would-be practitioner, and it was better that the general public were kept ignorant of its existence so they wouldn't be tempted to experiment and hurt themselves. But Gussie, the more observant and better read amongst you, cry, if discretion is your watchword, how do you explain your de-toppering activities at Goodwood, or the occasional bout of constabulary dehelmeting, or that time you enchanted a tree in Kew Gardens to sing the flower duet from Lakme? Aha, I answer. You'll notice that none of those japes had any lasting consequences, nor were they so obvious that anybody, other than a fellow practitioner, would notice. So I must say I was a bit miffed by Nightingale's breezy assumption that I had fessed up everything to Lucy.
When you say magic is real, what do you mean? Said Lucy, who, as I have indicated, is as sharp as a tack. Are you talking Houdini or hoodoo?
The latter, said Nightingale, although we don't call it that.
There was a long pause in the conversation, which I took advantage of to address my fried chicken, which truly deserved a great deal more attention than it was getting from both Lucy and Nightingale. Fried chicken is one of America's great contributions to world culture, one which has been sorely overlooked by both natives and incomers alike.
Can anyone know when something is unusual? Or is this a special ability only available to smartly dressed Englishmen? Asked Lucy.
Think of it as being able to tell ragtime from stride, I said. Everybody can tell there's a difference, but you have to know music to understand what the difference is.
I'm sure Gussie can explain in detail later, said Nightingale. The important thing is that something of a magical nature has spent time in that club.
Recently? Asked Lucy.
That's hard to say, said Nightingale. It would depend on the intensity of the original source. Do you think the owner will be there tonight?
Lucy said that he thought it likely, and that is when Nightingale developed a sudden desire to sample the nightlife of New York in general and the Alexandra in particular. I agreed to take him only on the basis that the sooner we located these enchanted instruments, the sooner Nightingale would return home. Lucy declared that he would return to his office and catch up on his work, but not before making it clear that he and I would be discussing recent developments in more detail later. Rather than look for a cab on Lenox Avenue, I introduced Nightingale to the delights of the New York subway, which is every bit the equal of the underground. We arrived back at my flat to find that Beauregard had prepared the guest room and unpacked Nightingale's steamer trunk, which had been delivered while we were out. I pleaded fatigue, retired to my bedroom, and had Beauregard bring me a brandy and soda. "Go easy with the soda and splash the brandy about with abandon," I told him. Prohibition, that bizarre aberration of the American spirit, could be dashed confusing to someone raised in the free and easy metrop of old London. New Yorkers seemed just as keen on their booze as the chaps back home, but every so often, some bally politico would declare that they were dead set on enforcing the Velocipede Act, although quite what it had to do with bicycles I never understood, and closed down clubs and speakeasies willy-nilly. New Yorkers, to a man, woman, and child, regarded these spasms in much the way a Londoner regards rain and fog, dashed inconvenient, but one of those things that are beyond the ken of mortal man, and not something that could be allowed to interfere with the social whirl. One unfortunate upshot, however, was that the available booze was often appalling. They call much of it bathtub gin, and they are not joking about the bathtub. As a result, I tried to be parsimonious with my imported brandy while letting Beauregard siphon off a bottle or two as a side benefit. I would have welcomed Nightingale with far greater bonhomie had he brought a case or two of the good stuff with him. I wanted to be with Lucy, not least so I could reassure him about the magic. but we can never risk him staying the night at the flat, and there was no chance of me slipping away for a tryst at his place while Nightingale was here. I lay on my bed, nursing my brandy and soda, and closed my eyes until the old bean had stopped spinning. Now, many of those who know me, including no few members of my own family, regard me as something of a dunce, and I will be the first to admit that I have never been what some might call a serious person. Still, you didn't have to be a brain to see that there was more to the current caper than interest in a stray saxophone, no matter how magical it might be. For one thing, I had always been led to believe that the good old United States was off limits to the folly, due to some unpleasantness involving the 1812 overture, and that visiting practitioners were admonished not to practice while visiting. And, for another, Thomas Nightingale was, if the rumours were to be believed, the folly's top man, the one sent out to deal with dastardly foreign plots and intractable disputes. If he were in New York, it was for a damned good reason, and one thing was for certain. The well-being and happiness of Augustus Berrycloth Young, Esquire, would not be a priority. Still, it is also said of good old Berrycloth Young that we are surprisingly hardy in the face of adversity, and quick to spring back from whatever unkind blows the cruel hand of fate may land upon us. The best thing, I surmised, was to help Nightingale finish his business as swiftly as possible, with as little involvement from me as possible, and then wave him off at the docks. That was the ticket, I thought, and fortified by the last of my brandy and soda, I arose and stepped forth to see what selection Beauregard had made for this evening's entertainment. Now, there are Philistines, and the sort of barbarians that were said to have plagued ancient Rome, who assert that one tuxedo is much like any other. The evening wear laid out for me was a beautiful deep blue, and the trousers, while still straight, had a pleat so that they fell in a much more becoming manner. The jacket was high-waisted but didn't have the raked pockets that set apart my newer suits. Once we had both dressed, Nightingale and I met in the living room to use the wall mirror and make final adjustments under Beauregard's critical eye. Nightingale's suit, I was pleased to see, was a much more traditional shade of black and conventionally cut, although it was tailored very well and suited him perfectly. He was, as one wag back in London once said, dangerously handsome and frustratingly unattainable.
"It's a pity your friend Mr. Gibbs can't be with us," said Nightingale, as he adjusted his bow tie in the mirror.
"They wouldn't let him inside," I said. "It's white only." He paused in his adjustments, but his eyes never left the mirror.
"Ah,"
he said.
"That's a shame. I found him quite interesting."
I am not by nature a violent man. It's true, I was involved in the usual playful scuffles and occasional fisticuffs at Oxford, and in the aftermath of the boat race, but nothing that led to lasting injury. But by God, I was seized by a sudden urge to take hold of Nightingale and throw him out of the window. He has a reputation, but I was no slouch in the basic form I, and I was sure that I could have him safely defenestrated before he could formulate a counterspell. Beauregard cleared his throat.
"Shall I order the taxi now, sir?" he asked.
"Yes, thank you, Beauregard," I said, and picked up my cane from the umbrella stand by the door.
"Is that the cane you're bringing?"
asked Nightingale. "What's wrong with this one?"
"It lacks a certain something," he said.
"Ah," I said, "I see," and went to fetch my cane with the etched steel handle from its carrying case in my wardrobe. This cane has a metal core and is noticeably heavier than my preferred hickory and silver-capped model. When I picked it up, I felt a single, pure note and a wash of heat that made me shiver. I had paid a pretty penny for this cane, but had never used it to cast so much as a wear-light. "Solve the mystery," I said to myself, "and the Nightingale flies home."
"Gussie,"
called Nightingale.
"Our car is here."
"Right ho," I called back.